On this episode of V8 Radio, we've got kind of a special presentation. It's a companion piece to a video we posted on Muscle Car of the Week recently. Today we're going to be airing the extended version of an interview we did with Stan Antlosser, who was the owner and driver of the world's fastest Pontiac Tempest back in the early days of Superstock racing. Now, Stan and I had a great time talking about the car and what it was like to race and all kinds of stuff when we met up with him shooting an episode of Muscle Car of the Week. The 1963 World's Fastest Tempest now resides in the Brothers Collection and was a recent subject in an episode of Muscle Car of the Week. And when we posted the video, we got a lot of response from people saying, hey, this is cool. The only problem with this episode is that we wish it was longer. So today, we're going to grant that wish and air the entire version of this sit-down interview we did with Stan Antlosser, covering a lot of different topics here on V8 Radio. I'm Kevin Ostie. Make sure you get a comfortable chair or download this one because it is pretty long. It's over an hour and a half. But Stan tells a lot of great stories about what it was like to race back then, the tricks they did to the car, what was special about the car, and life in general as a regular guy trying to race in Superstock back in the 60s. And we hope you enjoy it. Here it comes.
V8 Radio.
All right, Stan, let's just start real general. What are we sitting in front of here today?
We're sitting in front of Pontiac's last effort to win Superstock. In 1963, actually, let's go back to 62, General Motors was given a edict by the government that they were to get out of racing or they were going to have the company split up into divisions, separate divisions. So at that time, we were told in 62 what was going on. And of course, we were, you know, what are we going to do for cars? And everybody was contacted by engineering and said, okay, your car is this, you come and get it such and such a date. And when they called me up, I went and drove to Pontiac, drove this car home, and kind of an interesting sidelight, about halfway on the way home, I ran out of gas. At the time, I didn't know it, and the tank said full. And what was tricky about the car was when they put the automatic in the back, the four-speed, they cut the gas tank in half, and the gauge stuck in the full position. And I'm driving along, all of a sudden the car quits running. So I pull over and I couldn't figure it out. Then I went and checked to see if there was any gas going to the carburetors. And I pulling the levers on the side and no gas. And I thought, how could that be? The tank says full. So I went to a gas station, picked up a gallon can of gas. It worked. And then I went and filled it up and it only took 10 gallons. That was it. So I kind of chewed engineering out a little bit. I had an engineer that was kind of my, not mine alone, but anytime I needed anything from engineering, any information or parts or anything like that, I would talk to Bill Klinger. He was my engineer at the factory. And I called him up and I said, you guys, next time try to put some gas in the tank. And he kind of laughed after I told him the story, but that's kind of an unusual part of it.
Do you know anything about that edict the government said? Why did they say get out of racing?
Well, at that time, as I understood it, General Motors had over 25% of the sales. Now, back then, you know that there were four manufacturers. You had AMC, Ford, Chrysler, and GM. So they, again, as they normally interfere, this is what they did. They got involved and said, well, you guys have got a big percentage, and we don't want you to get any bigger. And that was pretty much, I don't know word for word, but that's what I was kind of told about that situation.
So it seems that even the government recognized that racing was good for selling.
Oh, yeah. It was race on Sunday, sell on Monday. That was the edict that the dealers used and the car manufacturers as well.
You referenced that you had an insider at GM Engineering, Pontiac.
Yes.
Kind of tell me your relationship. What were you doing for a living back then? How did you fit into all that?
I was an electrician. My father was an electrician, and I went to electrical training school, apprentice school, and became a journeyman electrician, took the test, and worked the way I was supposed to, have so many hours of on-the-job training. So I did that. And this is kind of a funny part of our racing then and today's racing. It's so much different because we had to work, you know, and you couldn't be driving during the week to another track. And so The racing was kind of limited. But I was out there every weekend, and sometimes twice on a weekend, because as soon as the weather got nice in Detroit, Detroit Dragway opened up on Saturday night, so we'd go to Saturday night and race, and then Sunday we'd go somewhere else to another track.
And primarily, tell me what class and what organization you raced in.
Well, I was under NHRA, and I'd been with NHRA since the 50s, late 50s. And so all the car was set up for NHRA to NHRA specs. The car was in super stock. It had to weigh no less than 3,200 pounds, and you had to use pump gasoline. Some of the others didn't use it. They used the high test aircraft gas, but we, you know, I didn't ever want anything somebody to come back to me and say, oh, you did this or you did that. The car was legal. I never worried about it. I just drove it. Worked on it as well.
Tell me the story how you were in a position to go pick up a brand new car to go racing. What was that all about?
Well, since they had the car all set up, it was actually filtered through a dealership. And back then, the dealer's names went on the car where the car was picked up from. And of course, I owned the car. I bought the car at that time. I hate to tell you how much it was, because it was pretty cheap when you think about it today. But if you want to know, it was $3,100. And that was as it was, all ready to go. Everything was set up, all ready to go. What happened is engineering actually built these cars. They weren't, the body came off the assembly line. It went to engineering. They put the four-speed transmissions in, the engines, and the rest of the parts to the car.
Okay. Now, this is definitely not something that an average person could have walked into their local Pontiac dealer to buy. Tell me what's different between this one and a regular street production Tempest.
The transmission, for one thing. The street Tempest had a two-speed automatic in the rear. It had no more than a 326 cubic inch. They had an HO engine. They called it HO. They had a little bit hotter cam and a four-barrel carburetor on it. That was max. That was it. So you were running probably about 400 horsepower less than what we were putting out in the race Tempest. There were six of these vehicles built. Actually, he was my neighbor, Paul Goldsmith, who raced NASCAR, raced one of these and won that particular class and beat everybody at that time.
This car, tell me about the motor and the transmission that was in it when you got it.
Okay, it came with the Super Duty 421 motor with the dual four barrels, the camshaft, all the latest parts, the 63 421 motors. And it did have the automatic transmission in it, but instead of having a cable drive from the motor, from the motor to the transmission in the rear, it had an actual drive shaft. Also, we had a clutch assembly that when you took off, you let the clutch out for low gear, and then you shifted the automatic transmission. We did some testing with that vehicle. I had had the motor, as soon as I got it back, this was in February, of course, so we had winter time. We pulled the motor out and had it balanced and did all the, get the motor to specs, to factory specs, had it all ready to go and put it back in the car. Took the car out to Detroit Dragway in April and made some runs with it. The car just didn't perform well, and of course with an automatic transmission you lose 20% of your horsepower right off the top, and I just figured the way it was set up, that was one detrimental thing, as well as we could only get a 3.9 gear. A 3.9 gear wasn't enough, because in 62 I was testing gear ratios and transmissions to see what the best combination was, and as a matter of fact the big cars came out with that same 430 gear with the NASCAR three-speed transmission. Actually, some of them had four speeds. I guess guys like to shift three times instead of two. So I made several runs with it. It was very disappointing to me, because all that horsepower, and there was nothing I could do with it. It just wasn't there. You lost too much. I was going through the traps, and I could have kept going beyond the traps because of the gear ratio.
In that setup, the drive shaft was spinning at engine RPM?
Yeah.
So that's kind of creepy, isn't it?
Yeah, it was scary, but That's the way they set up. Well, it came. Now, don't forget the transmission shifted to another, you know, it was a four-speed trans, so it actually shifted to a different gear ratio. It was direct drive, however, at the end.
Tell me about this Super Duty 421. Was this something that was more of a NASCAR motor or more of just a big car motor?
Well, that was their NASCAR motor as well. The only difference was they used a four-barrel carburetor on it rather than two four-barrels. We had two four-barrels. And I actually had the 1962 421. They came out with it in 62, and one came with my 61 389 Super Duty car. I never got a chance to run it, but I had that motor as well and could have run it. The biggest difference was between the two motors was the new 63 421. The engineering redesigned the intake manifold, much, much, much better manifold. It was a high rise, it had everything level, so all the gas flowed evenly through all eight of the barrels of the manifold. And they also redesigned the heads, gave us bigger heads, that helped. And then of course they came out with the air scoop that you see on it now. That was an add-on item along with an Iske 505 camshaft. 505 was actually the lift of the total lift of the valves by the camshaft, whereas the standard one we ran was a 447.447 lift. Am I getting too technical?
Not at all. Perfect. This okay. is all great info. I'm going to back you up just a little bit.
Okay.
We started talking about how you owned the car, but it ended up with the dealer name on the door.
Okay.
Let's expand upon that again. Tell me a little bit more about how that...
Okay. Therefore, when the dealer's name was on the car, they had full, total... monetary responsibility for the car. Any parts that were needed, anything that had to be done to the car, for example, getting the motor blueprinted and balanced, they paid for that, and they ended up paying for the rear end when we changed the rear end as well. And it wasn't a lot of money in those days, believe it or not. They probably didn't have, if they spent $4,000 a year, that was max.
And the benefit for them was the advertising.
Oh, yeah. The car ran everywhere it went. The car today, as you know, is so well known that all you have to do is mention it. And anybody that's been in racing knows, and it's been in five magazines up till now. And, of course, it hasn't been out to the track. But once it went on eBay, that again gave it a big boost as well, brought it back. And everybody knew about it. Actually, I was looking for the car for about 5 years in the 90s. I had guys across the country looking for it, but it didn't pan out. There was people said they had it, and when I tried to see it, because I would know the car, nobody would show it to me, so I never did see it. And it was sitting all that time, 40-some years, in a yard, and it wasn't fully covered. It was actually just had a roof, and it was between two buildings, two stalls, and it was there for 40-plus years. And the other ironic part about it, one of the guys that knew the car was there knew I was looking for it, and he never ever got a hold of me, so I never had the opportunity to get the car.
Oh, man. What was in it for you back in those days as a racer?
Fun. There was a little bit of money, but... it paid for the gasoline, basically, when you got down to it. We towed the car, actually it was ironic, we towed the car, flat towed it, which means we had a tow bar in the front of it, and the car was on the street. We had street tires on it to tow the car, and the other racing tires were in the trunk.
What'd you tow with?
I had a, let's see, what did I have back then? Oh, boy, I can't remember for sure. I can remember the other Pontiac, but I can't remember this one.
Was it a
I know. I did remember. Hate to say this, but I had a Ford pickup, the Ranchero, the big car, Ford Ranchero. That's what I towed it with because it had lots of room for putting parts and stuff in.
Interesting. Okay, so we've touched a little bit upon the engine and the drive line in the car. What else is special about this one versus a street version as far as lightweight parts and different stuff?
Well, this one is completely different than even the other five Tempests that were built by engineering, in the fact that because the car wasn't running up to snuff, by the way, I want to mention Ted Henke was the man who worked on the car with me. In fact, he's the one that got me into Pontiac because he was driving the original Packer cars. And he went into the service and called me up and said, would you like to drive the Packer car? And I said, yes, of course, and went down and met with Bill Packer and signed on. He says, I just want to see the car racing. He got it every weekend. And lots of wins, too, with that car as well. But we thought about it. Ted and I thought about it and what to do, and there was no solution for a gear ratio. Well, I called engineering. They said, that's the only gear ratio we had for the car. And, of course, the automatics, I knew enough to know that we were losing 20% of our horsepower through the automatics because of the fluid flow situation. So I don't know which one of us said it for sure, but we talked about it and we thought, you know, Mickey Thompson put a 57 Pontiac rear end in his Tempest, took the automatic out and that, and he won the Nationals with it. So that was it. Him and I decided to do that. We took the automatic out. I had a shop where I had the garage and everything. We could work on the car. And we put it up in the air, took the new parts out, measured everything, and got the 57 rear end, which was a little bit shorter than the later, because I think it was 59 they came out with the wide track. So 57, 58 was the only one you could use. We found a 57. Did the measurements, went to Logie Stamping in Detroit. Actually, they were not in Detroit, but they were outside of Detroit, and they were a very well-known drag racing group, as well as they had a total shop where they could do anything and build anything. So we gave them the measurements, and they built the whole rear end. We put a 430 gear in it. I had already, by that time, learned how to put a rear end together. I actually kind of learned this stuff as I was going along because it was a little different than some of the stuff that I had raced. But I learned it well enough that everything worked. And we got it done, put it in, and boy, right away that car just, the mile an hour just went up. And when you increase mile an hour, you know you're increasing the horsepower. Mm-hmm. So we just, from there on, we just kept working with it and working with it and winning races, of course, in between.
How was this, how did the engine like that 430 gear?
Well, as I said, I tested in 62 with the big car. I tested gear ratios and I tested transmission ratios. And the 430 was max for the Pontiac motor because it was out of horsepower at 5,800 RPMs. I would shift about 6 to 62, and I only had two shifts from low to second to third, or to high gear. And torque on these engines was very low, and that was one of the deficits we kept trying to overcome by using different tire sizes and anything we could figure out. But that was one of our deficits. The 7-inch tires that we had to run just didn't hold the car in place at all. The car weighed 3,200 pounds, and that was without gasoline. Because if we went to a track and raced like I did at Detroit before the Nationals, and we were underweight, we lost. So in order to keep the car legal, you got to respect the dealer. They're the ones putting the money in it, and Pontiac, you know, with the car. So we kept everything as straight as it could be.
Now, did you have to do anything special to be able to buy this car from Pontiac? I mean, the concept of GM building a race car and selling it to...
Well, because I drove the Packer car for almost two years, I took it over in 61, and then during the winter time, we pulled the motor and refreshed the motor and put it back together and had it ready for the 62 season, and I ran it all the way through the Nationals in 62. And of course, they knew what I was doing. They know whether you're good or bad, or you can do it or you can't do it. Otherwise, they're not going to give you a car, mm-hmm. you know, like that. That I don't know what it cost them to build it, but I'm sure it was very expensive. Mm-hmm. So, like I say, when Bill called me up and said, you know, you're to pick your car up February, and I don't remember the exact date, come down to engineering and pick it up, and that's what I did. Took it back. We didn't letter it at the beginning. I have photos of it when we first had it at Detroit Dragway, because I didn't want it. I wanted to make sure everything was good before we put the lettering on. Once we put the rear end in, we knew it was going to run faster. We had no question about it, because Mickey Thompson did run much better and very well. As I say, he won the Nationals in California, I should say, not here, but in California.
And what did GM think? I imagine their motivation was that you needed to win.
Well, the story behind the rear end is kind of funny because when they were restoring a car, one of the guys said that, well, you should put it back to the way it came from the factory. Well, that would have set the car back. There would have been no use doing that. Before we did this, and again, it's a little detail I should have probably mixed in with when we were doing this, but I called up Bill and I said, Bill Klinger, and I said, Bill, we're going to put a 57 rear end in just like Mickey did. What do you want us to do? He said, give me a list of all your parts. We'll have part numbers on them. We'll submit them to NHRA so you can run the car legally. And I ran it the rest of the year, probably 3-4 months legally without anybody. Nobody could protest. And if they did, the parts were there.
So you guys were smart.
Well, you know, at that age, I'm not sure. But it was the only way out. I was disappointed in the car because when the 61 car could run 110 miles an hour and a quarter mile, and this car with the automatic could only run 113, I knew something was wrong. First of all, you had a motor that put out, the 389 put out an honest 405 horsepower on the dyno, and this motor put out 550 horsepower. You know, that's a lot of horsepower, plus the car was lighter. The 61 car weighed 3,860 pounds on the scale, and that's with aluminum front bumper, no radio, no heater, no dum-dum. I mean, it is as light as it could be. Why shouldn't this car run 120 miles an hour? And then it eventually did.
What was different that allowed this car to be so light?
It had an aluminum front end on it. The bumpers on the car were acid dipped and then chromed. The intake manifold, of course, was all aluminum. It came with headers from the factory. Of course, engineering built the headers, and they built a whole exhaust system for the cars just in case NHRA required it, but they kind of backed off that, and nobody had a whole exhaust system on a car. The battery was in the trunk to keep weight over the rear end. And the headers. George DeLorean built the headers on this car, and it made such a difference. I think all those little things that we put together, the rear end, the transmission, the headers, everything made that car much a better car. And it ran.
And tell me about the class. I mean, this was a different time, and this was AFX, correct?
Well, actually, we ran Super Stock throughout the year because of the fact that the decision wasn't made until the Nationals to put them in AFX class. They had AFX. The big cars had to run BFX, and we had to run AFX. But up until that time, we all ran 3,200 pounds there, no more than 427 cubic inches. 204 bells if you want, you know, headers. So everything was pretty equal. I mean, the ramp chargers were acid dipping their bodies, all the Mopars, to keep them light and get them down to the 3,200 pounds, which is okay. And probably by a mid-season, we were pretty much ahead of the game until about mid-season. Of course, the ramp chargers are all engineers at Chrysler, and they developed a better set of heads and another camshaft, and it picked them up considerably. But even then, when I ran them, I ran 3 miles an hour faster than they did. And because we both used 7-inch tires, that was to my detriment. I lost off the starting line. I couldn't get the traction. But we were side by side in the traps. We didn't even know who won at that time. And Dave Thornton was driving the car at that time.
So you raced with some interesting people. I mean, who else were you competing against those days?
Well, the Fords and the Chevrolets, Don Nicholson, I ran Nicholson down in Union Hill, Tennessee, had a Super Stock meet down there and beat him. And the big Ford guy was, trying to recall his name. I beat him and Nicholson and the other Pontiac Tempest that was a clone because it was a car that was taken off the lot and converted the way mine car was. And ran just as fast, actually, at that time. But it didn't get the recognition because it wasn't an NHRA legal car at the time. So we went out, him and I both, Arlen Vanke and I both went out with the cars. We almost appeared at the same time. And it's kind of another funny story. And again, it's never been out there anywhere. But we ran each other at two different racetracks at Union Hill, Tennessee. We ran for the trophy. It was $500, actually, not a trophy. It was probably a trophy, too. And then I also raced him at Dragway 42 in Ohio. And, of course, we traveled with that car. We went to Indy. We went to Ohio. We went to Columbus. We went down to Union Hill, Tennessee. And the ironic part about both of them is when that car was built originally, we had trouble with the axles not holding up. When we got torque, we would actually break the axles. And the guy that owned the drag strip up 26 Mile in Gratiot, which was Motor City Dragway, owned a plant in Detroit where they heat-treated materials. And so he came to me one day when we broke an axle, and he said, why don't you get me the specs from Pontiac, and you know, the I forget what it's called, the hardening specs, and he says, I'll do some axles for you, and took care of that problem. But I already raced Vanke once for $500. I broke an axle against him. The next time I ran him at the other track, it was just two of us again at the end, I blew a clutch. And of course, Arlen comes up to me and he says, Stan, when are you going to keep that car together so we can finish a race? But it was pretty close at the beginning. We were pretty close in low gear, and I had always second gear. Every time I hit second gear, it was either the axle or the clutch. And I only blew one clutch, though. The axles were the big problem. We got that straightened out finally. But the clutches, one time, that was it. So the car ran all year with the same clutch. Never had a problem with it. 11-inch clutch.
Tell me about that racing season. I mean, what tracks did you race at? How did the season go?
Well, I didn't lose any races until August, and that was the race against the Ram Chargers. Other than that, I raced at every track, US 131, Stanton in Central Michigan, Detroit Dragway, Motor City Dragway, and I have all the timing slips from all those tracks too, so everything is accurate as to what the slips say, and I didn't make the slips, so you know, that's the fact. Everybody asks, well, who made the, but they came from the track, they had numbers on them, everything was on it, so there's nothing anybody could argue. And of course it had the write-ups too. In fact, the race against the Ram Chargers was in the December 1963 popular Hot Rodding. The only problem is whoever wrote the article didn't realize that I didn't have a station wagon, I had a coupe. But they had the times were in there. They ran a better ET than I did. And of course they had excellent suspension compared to what we had, especially with the 7-inch tires. And we ran 3 miles an hour faster. Now, like I say, we were the fastest car, the fastest speed car at that meet. And that was the Detroit Dragway Superstock Nationals is what they called it. And so it was the Ram Chargers and us left, and that was it. Otherwise, I had no problems with the car. It was like the 61 car. I lost the Nationals with that car, unfortunately, because we pulled the rocker studs out in the trophy run. They had a weakness. The Pontiac engine had a weakness. It's kind of off the story. I don't know if I want to get into the 61 car at all, but that car won virtually every race it was in except that one race because of the rocker arms. They cured it. The new cars all had screw and stud rocker arms, so they didn't lose them. But, yeah, it did very well through the years. And the two races I lost there were with Vanke and should not. Maybe I could have beat him. We're both seasoned drivers, so we don't know. But it was kind of interesting about the car. As I mentioned earlier, I was looking for it for about 5 years, and I had the word out from coast to coast with the Pontiac guys. We're all looking for it, and I was getting calls and that. Of course, every time somebody called, I was always suspicious. Oh, well, is this going to be it? You know, I kept getting my hopes up. But I was on my way back from Vegas, not even gambling, but I was on my way back from there, and I got a phone call on my cell phone. This guy who I knew said, they found your car. I said, oh, good, where'd they find it this time? He said, well, they verified it's your car, and then he gave me the whole spiel, and he said, by the time you get home, you'll have pictures. I've got pictures of all the parts in the car, everything as it was found. So that's how I found out. And at that time, the bidding had started on it at very low, $50, I believe, was the start. It went to $500 real fast, and it just started snowballing. And I had some guys from Chicago call me and ask me, they said, if you would like to, if we put you up in Chicago, would you come if we get the car and help us put it together so it's correct? And I said, sure, no problem. I was, of course, retired by then, so it didn't matter. And they missed it by pennies. So there was two bidders in there at the end that just had a real war, and of course it cost a lot of money back then.
How did the car get away? I mean, what was the end of your time with this thing?
Well, that's another funny story. George DeLorean and I talk about that once in a while. When we were racing, you were always going to get the next car, see, and it always went on that way. And of course, I sold the Tempest, and I had it wrong back then. People were asking me when, and I had no thoughts of it for a number of years, obviously. And apparently, I showed it at the Autorama show in Detroit in January of 64. So sometime after that, I had sold the car, and then I never saw or heard of it again at that point.
And when was the last time you laid eyes on this car?
Boy, January of 64. That was the last time I saw the car. When I sold the car, I'm sure it was sold because I had a for sale sign at the... In fact, I'll get you a picture of that, too, with the for sale sign on it. And somebody apparently came up and was interested in the car and bought it. And that was it.
Until?
Today. First time I've seen that car in actuality, I keep waiting for somebody to say, hey, you want to come and see your car? Scott, I've known Scott for a number of years, and we stayed in touch. He wanted to make sure the car was accurate, and anytime he needed information, I said, no problem, just let me know. And I sent him pictures and gave him as much information as I could. Never heard from the guy that bought the car, but Scott kept in touch. Mm-hmm. And then I got pictures, as I say. Got a ton of photos from when it was each stage of it being built and that as well.
So tell me about your racing career after this car. What happened?
Well, I raced several cars after that, actually. And they were Mopars, believe it or not. I built two 64 cars. I built a Plymouth with a Stage 3 426 motor in it. And I built a Dodge 9-passenger station wagon with a Stage 3 Mopar motor in it. And I've got pictures of all these cars. And the paint jobs on them are extraordinary. I had a buddy that painted cars, and anytime I wanted a car painted, he would paint it, and he did such a job. In fact, I'll send you some of those color pictures. Gold leaf lettering on the side and pearl paint on the car, because pearl paint was invented by a guy back in Michigan. So they were really neat cars. The last car I had was one of 50 of the hemispherical chambered Dodge Darts. That was an interesting car. It was a fiberglass front end, very light car, very fast car. I went through and redid the motor in the wintertime, checked everything out. I took everything apart in a shop, just like we did with the Pontiac, and put it back together. And the car ran 135 and a quarter, and it ran down in the 10.3s. Of course, it should. You know, that big horsepower motor, that's easily 650, close to 700 horsepower. 68, yeah. I have pictures of that as well, and had a magnesium cross ram manifold on it when I had a set of headers built for it. And of course, we did the motor just like we did the Pontiac. Went through it, balanced it, and all that stuff.
Wow, too cool. So what was the fastest this thing ever ran?
The fastest speed was 123.95. That was at US 131. It was backed up with several 120-mile-an-hour runs, so it wasn't a fluke speed. The best ET it had was with the 10-inch slicks, of course. They got a better bite, and that was 11.91. The car would run, and I went through the slips the other day. I don't know why I did it, but I've got them in an envelope, and I went and dug them out and went through them because I wanted to see what the car turned. I wasn't sure it had been so long since I really looked at them. The car was very consistent. If I could have run as fast against the Ram Chargers, I would have beat them, ET-wise. But I guess the tracks are different, as a lot of guys know, and that was the difference, because the car would run the low 12s with the 7-inch tires.
And where did this car come along in your racing career?
Well, in 63, I actually started out in 1956 with a Studebaker Golden Hawk. That was also a very special car. It had what was called back then a patrician motor in it. The big Packard, it was a Packard V8 with dual four barrels, Iskenderian E4 camshaft, and a dual point ignition. And of course, I had a 427 gear in the back and traction bars on it, and it was a stick shift. And that car ran in the high 14s back then, which was very fast. But the motor put a lot of horsepower out. They rated it, I believe, about 285 then, but I know it was over 300. Mm-hmm. And we didn't do what those motors what we did to these motors. You know, we didn't blueprint them or anything. We just put the package in and went and raced. Then the next car I had was a 59 Chevrolet with the big motor and a 335 horsepower, 348 with a stick shift. And I didn't actually race that on a track because I had a 40 Ford coupe with a hemispherical, 392 hemispherical motor with six Stromberg 97s and a Chet Herbert roller cam in it. In fact, I won my first trophy with that car, believe it or not. It was in the same time era. So I didn't race the Chevy. I just drove it on the street pretty much.
So you...
Then came the Pontiacs in 61, 62, 63, and then the Mopars. Somewhere around 60, 65 with the 64 cars, the 264 cars. Then the 68 Dart came in later.
So you were just not necessarily brand loyalist. You were trying to go fast.
I just loved the race. It gets in your blood and it don't go away. And I hate to say it, in those days, you know, we street raced too. I hope my kids don't see this. No, it doesn't matter. You know, where we went, there was nobody else around. It was out in the boonies, and, you know, once in a while we had to go out. You know, like Woodward Avenue is a big street racing deal. So guys did that. The Ram Chargers had their garage, Woodward Avenue garage car with a Hemi in it, a Dart. So they were on the street with it. Jim Wangers had that goat with a 421 in it on the street. I didn't get quite that deep in. I'd rather race on the track. Mm-hmm. That was more fun.
Do you know those guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, I know a lot of guys. You know, it's kind of funny when you think about it, but... Even the competitors, I can't always remember guys' names, but like the Golden Commandos and the Ram Chargers, McCullough Ricky's Plymouth, and the Ford guys, Dave Lyle, and the Chevrolet guys, Nicholson, the guy that raced for Mickey Thompson. Names start to slip when you get older. But anyway, so, you know, we talked amongst each other. It was, you know... You're friendly in the pits, but once you're on the track, that's it. You go all out. That's the way you do it.
Okay, so at this point, by day, you're an electrician.
Right.
Take me through a typical week where you knew you had a race on the weekend.
Okay. Of course, the season always started out on a Sunday. So we had Saturday, and at night I could go to the shop and we could work on a car. And sometimes I had buddies that would come over and like to learn about it and work on it. You know, there's always physical stuff. Like we'd take the whole front end off the car so we could get at everything very easily, easy access. And it's just like the Mopar, the Dart. I've got pictures of it with all the front end off and everything, and the motors out of the car and everything. So we work on it sometimes at night, depending on how much had to be done. Over the winter, we had a lot of time to put the motor together, get the motor done right, take our time, put everything together, and be ready for April, and that's when we usually started. And at that time, then, we had a dual deal. Once we started on the Sundays, it was okay because you had Saturday to change the oil. Every time we were done racing, or at least I was done racing, I pulled the oil and filter out of the car, change it, put the heavyweight oil and the filter back in it, and be ready, check the spark plugs, adjust the valves, have it all ready to go to the track the next day on Sunday. Now, when it got to be running Saturday night, coming back, going to bed, getting up early in the morning, having to get out to the track before 8 o'clock, that was another story. But when we got out there, the first thing I did was check those things to see if they were okay. Normally, you wouldn't have too many problems with the valves, the clearances on the valves and that, and the spark plugs occasionally. But I usually kept a spare set of brand new plugs, and if the plugs were dirty, I'd just pull them and put the new ones in.
At the end of the day, Sunday?
Go home. That was it. Usually it was a pretty long day, and some of the treks like to Stanton, which was central Michigan, was like, it was close to about 70 miles one-way trip, and towing a car, of course, you know, you flat towed them back then. It took a lot out of the racing and trying to keep the car in shape. But once you had it down and you knew what to do, it wasn't that difficult. You had a routine and you just did it.
And what kind of electric work were you doing?
I worked construction, and I worked on probably every type of building you could imagine, from some of the automotive plants to high-rise building. I did some custom houses in Grosse Pointe, which is a ritzy area. That's where the Fords and the Dodges lived. But every type of building you can imagine. I've seen every piece of a car manufactured from the very beginning, from engine blocks to dashboards to whatever you want to talk about. I've seen them all. I've seen them stamp the fenders, stamp the hoods, and do all that stuff. They take the rear ends out, which was kind of interesting to me, and a lot of people don't know some of this stuff, is when they cast, like, the rear end housings and the pig section where the gears are, and even some of the cast iron stuff, they would leave it outside in bins, and that actually aged the material and made it better, and I never knew that. That's what the engineers said, and I know they did it because you could see it. So it was another little thing. I learned a lot about cars. I was able to go into a lot of these plants. I watched Cadillacs put together. I watched Dodge trucks put together, Ford trucks, Chevrolets, Pontiacs, just about anything.
All right, so you mentioned in the wintertime that you would go through the motors. Tell me about your blueprint process. I mean, what would you do to these things?
Well, we always had the blueprints from the factory and the specifications of the clearances, for one thing. Also, thousands of an inch we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It was something really that I learned about. I had some teachers that, when I say teachers, guys that were experts and knew how to do this. I learned how to put a camshaft in an engine and do all the stuff that had to be done little by little through the years from like 56 right on up. I was learning things. I never could put a rear end gear together in a car before 61 when the Packard guy showed me how to do it. He laid it out on the bench, put the white paint on it. We checked the clearances, the end play, bearings, everything. So I learned it. You had to do it. And so every facet of the car I learned. I learned how to do the tune-ups too as well. And back then we didn't have computers. It was all seat of the pants, and I used to keep a record of the runs. What the temperature was, what the jet sizes were, valve lash, you could change valve lash too, and spark plugs sometimes would be changed, maybe a colder range if it was hot outside. So a lot of things, all these little things added up into a car really running fast the way it should. And as far as the blueprinting goes, if you have the correct clearances, piston to wall clearances, for example, it's interesting back then, and rebuilding the Packard motor, the 389, about 7 years ago, today the clearances are so close, I was shocked. For example, we used to have a piston to wall clearance, and that's where you'd put a piston in the chamber itself, check the clearance with feeler gauges between the wall and the piston, or Mike the piston and then inside Mike the wall. And we do that on every cylinder, mark the sizes on the top. So you knew, did it have to be honed out 1 or 2 thousandths to make the clearances? Well, for example, on the piston, the wall, we use the NASCAR specs. Oh, by the way, I want to also talk about very briefly, but one of the nicest guys was Ray Nichols from Nichols Engineering up in Highland, Indiana, who I could also call and get information if I needed to. Very nice guy. Ted introduced me to him because he worked with him when they built the Packard cars in the late 60s, 59 and 60, and the 61 car. But those clearances were real wild back then compared to what they do today, because they don't do, when you, I see 6,000 clearance piston in the wall, I'm thinking, boy, that's tight, because when the engine warms up, all that metal expands. But of course, the metals are better. The pistons today are nothing like what we ran back then. You know, they were cast, most of them. Some of them were extrude forged, where they take aluminum and kind of forge it that way, rather than a full forging, which was then cut to size. And that was the difference. And that's how the NASCAR motors are built today. These shops all have their own CNC machines, and they're so sophisticated. Once you put the program in, you just put the piece in, tighten it down, you can leave. The machine does everything that has to be done. Back then, we had guys that did it, you know, by hand. And we did, too. I had a shop where we could balance engines and do all of that machine work, the valves, everything that had to be done. So we had kind of an advantage in that respect, whereas I had a couple of guys working for me as well, so it wasn't just me. It was two other guys that could help out.
What was your, you know, kind of your mental process racing as far as how you approached drag racing?
Well, that's maybe an interesting story, I don't know. I read a lot of magazines when I was younger. I started when I was 16 reading car magazines. I could tell you how fast every car, 0 to 60, was back in the old days, the Buick Centuries and some of the other fast, the old 98s, and are they actually the 88s. I read an article by a very interesting man by the name of Roger Huntington one time, and he was an SAE engineer, and he was in a wheelchair, but a very smart man. He wrote a lot of tech articles, and I always read them. I learned how to shift a car from Roger Huntington reading his magazine article, because he said exactly what to do and how to do it, and it worked. So that's how I learned to shift the car. Now, the rest of it was all practice, getting out, dropping the clutch in it, because like today, you know, they've got the line locks and all the other sophisticated computer stuff, and they can do whatever they want with the car. But then it was seat of the pants, and, you know, you try not to be nervous, and anybody says they weren't or liars, because I know I was nervous. But once you made the first race, the first run, it was all over. Then you were into it, and it was just a matter of going along and doing what you always did.
And was this car, I mean, outside of, you know, axle breakage and tire nonsense, this thing ended up being pretty consistent?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. The mile and hours were always good. As I say, that happened later on when the axle started, probably mid-season. So we got that cured right away. The clutch didn't happen until after the season was over with, when we were going, like we went to Union Hill, Tennessee, and Dragway 42. That's when we had the clutch problems. I never dreamed that. Because what was funny is if I had had a spare clutch, we could have raced. Because the trans, pulling the trans on those things, we worked under the cars back then, you know. We had the jack and the jack stands and that, and four bolts hold the trans in, you disconnect the shifter, pull the shifter out, leave the shifter thing on the side, pull the, you know, it was nothing to work on those cars. Hmm. They were very simple. Today I look underneath some of these cars and I'm astounded. You got to go to school to learn what they need to know today.
Tell me about the complexity of that system in the, with the rear mount transaxle, and do you know why Pontiac got away from that? Or
I really don't, except one of the things that we knew right from the beginning was the transmissions were very weak. They couldn't take a lot of torque. In fact, when we pulled the one out of the Tempest, I actually sold it to Royal Pontiac for their station wagon. They had a 421 station wagon. And so they'd have some spare parts. But again, you couldn't have a good gear ratio. So it was basically okay for the street, but not any good for the strip. And of course, if you had a high horsepower, if a guy souped up a 326, you could put the 389 parts on a 326. The only difference was the bore and stroke. So if you up the horsepower, now you're going to have rear end problem. So I don't know the real true full story of what they did, why they did it, and when they did it. I just know that it was a very weak situation, and they finally got away from it. Because the GTOs didn't have it. 64.
I'm going to go a little bit broader scope. Tell me what was you know, the USA like in 61, 62, 63?
So much different from today that it's unbelievable. The things I see happening today are, you know, for example, the General Motors and all the corporations. What really bothered me is the reason that a guy that knew nothing about automobiles dumped Pontiac. Because, and the reason I say this is not just because I raced for him, but because of the fact they were coming out with a GTO. They already had the little two-door, two-seater, I lost it again. The
Solstice.
Solstice. And they had the G8, which was a high-performance four-door car, the G6, which was a high-performance V6 car. And another fact that actually Pontiac was the first one to build trucks for the United States. They were the first automotive manufacturer to build trucks. That's part of their history. Pontiac actually started in Pontiac, and it was named Oakland because of Oakland County. The county they were in was called Oakland County. They named it Pontiac after the Indian chief Pontiac, and that name stuck. And of course, the Arrowheads is the latest that they used. They had the Indian chief's head for many years, and sometimes the body, but then they went to the Arrowhead as their designated logo. But yeah, things are just so different today. There's so many restrictions put on. The computers are destroying the cars. And I have a friend that has an automotive shop, and he's really a sharp guy. His dad owned it first, and he's a pretty smart guy, and he works on any kind of car. He can handle four or five cars at once and has a couple of good guys working for him. And he says the same thing. It's so different. It's so hard today to work on cars because I can't work on my own car today. I can't change the plugs in my own car today because I have to pull the intake manifold off just to pull the spark plugs. And, you know, the simplicity was there today. It's just so technical. It's unbelievable. That's probably the biggest thing that I see difference-wise.
Scott Tiemann did the resto on this?
Yes, he did.
Tell me
about it.
He did
an excellent job. Scott's been doing Pontiacs for quite a while, and I've seen his work. He did George DeLorean's Tempest. George had a Tempest, too, by the way. He had the regular automatic rear end in his. And he did two or three of the superstock cars, and he's very... what's the word I want to use? I almost said intense, but he's so accurate. Everything he does is just as good as anything could be done. When you look at this car, you see the workmanship in it. It's better than when I had it brand new. I mean, I was surprised when I saw the pictures of the car, and he was sending me, I've got all the pieces laid out and what they did. For example, the front end on this car is another interesting story. The original front end was sold off the car, and it went to a man in Florida. And when I was looking for the car, I knew where the front end was, and I called the guy up, and I said to him, I want to put my car back together. And of course, he knew who I was by name, not personally, but by name. And I said, you know, if I put it back together, I'd like to put the original aluminum front end on it, because I knew you couldn't get those parts anymore. It consisted of the hood, the fenders, the fascia, and the panel underneath the bumper. Those were all aluminum. Plus the intake manifold was aluminum. But he said, if you get your car back, I would rather sell it to you than just sell it to somebody else. And I said, oh, great, I appreciate that. How much would you want for it? And he said, $10,000. Well, of course, but this was how many years ago in the 90s? That's a lot of money in the 90s as well. And I just said, oh, okay, well, I'll let you know if I find it. And I was still looking, and people were calling me, and I was asking questions. And I went to Detroit to look at a car. The guy stonewalled me so long, I never got to see the car. I was had tickets for a plane to go to the Midwest. I'm trying to remember where this guy said he had my car. And he put it off several times, and then finally I bought the ticket. I said, well, how about this weekend? I want to buy the tickets, and I want to be able to go look at the car and see if it's my car. I mean, wouldn't you like to know as well? Because there were only six of them built. Actually, there were seven, but the seventh one disappeared to Mercedes, as I understand it. I called him up. I called him on a Wednesday, because he was going to be out of town up until then. I said, okay, I've got tickets. I'm coming in Saturday morning. Can you pick me up from the airport? He said, oh, well, something else came up. Well, at that point, I just thought, you know, I'm hunting a dead mule or something. I don't know what, but it's just, I think at that point I was pretty much dissuaded that it's not going to happen. When all the time for 40-some years, it sat in a storage facility in Michigan, right, not, oh, I don't know, what is it, about an hour from where the car was built, roughly, from Pontiac, in a little town off the freeway. So that was the end of that deal.
What do you think would be best for this car? What would you like to see this thing do now?
I'd like to see how fast it'd run today with the new tires. I bet the ETs would be phenomenal. The traction you can get. That was our only weakness, and I think we made a mistake not putting traction bars on the back. But back then, we had limitations. It had to have the factory stock equipment, and we used the springs that were off the 57 because that was the part number that came with the rear end. If you change something, you know, somebody protests you, then you're... And I certainly didn't want to have Pontiac coming down on me about any of that stuff. You know, it wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. I never had any problems all the years, and it's just not worth it.
And what were you going to do with it if you found it?
Oh, I was going to put it back together pretty much. I just wanted to do it again. That was my idea. I knew because how rare it was, as I said, there were seven coupes built and six wagons. The one coupe Mercedes bought, as I understand it, and they wanted to research the car because I guess when they saw it run it, when Goldsmith won the 500 at in January down in Daytona, it was a special race for sports cars, and that's what class they ran it. And they ran it with that automatic rear end. And of course, that was okay. They were in high gear most of the time. So I don't know what else he did to the car. And actually, what was ironic about that, Goldsmith drove for Packer Pontiac in NASCAR, and I was racing and drag racing with him, and he was in my neighborhood. We lived in the same city. It wasn't real big. It was a small one.
Whatever happened to Stan Long Pontiac?
You know, I honestly don't know. I know they're out of business. I know Packer's out of business. And I just don't know. I moved out here. I've been in California 40 years now, so it's been a long time, and I lost track of that. Even though George and I get together every once in a while or go to the races, and he comes out here sometimes, and I go back there once in a while, I never even thought of it, to be honest with you. But I knew they were gone because somebody had told me. Royal's gone. I guess a lot of the older dealers are gone. And when they merged, like Buick, Oldsmobile, Cadillac, that's the dealer today for GM. It's such a beautiful city, it's sad to see what happened to it. If you go downtown Detroit, I mean, you have to see it because the city was founded in 1701. That's an old city by any means. I mean, California, as soon as California was settled, was in 1751.
I mean, it sounds like you had a pretty safe racing career.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I never thought it was dangerous, to be honest with you. I have never seen a death, and I only know off the top of my head three deaths. One of them was one of the Ram Chargers at Detroit Dragway. It's probably not very well known, but I happened to be on the standing line that when the Ram Chargers had this, I think it was a 48 Plymouth Coupe. They had it sitting real high, and they had the big headers coming out the side. I almost had the guy's name that drove, Erickson. I just remembered his name. The car took off, and it didn't get probably 100 feet, and all of a sudden I seen flames go up inside the car. What happened? The clutch broke, came through, cut the fuel line, and the tank was inside the car. It sprayed fuel all over the inside of the car and caught on fire. I think he succumbed after about 3 weeks in intensive care. That was the first actual somebody that died on the track, and since then it's only been two that I know of for sure. And I didn't see the one I saw when it after it happened, and that was one of John Force's drivers, that kid that hit the wall in practice. So I never thought it was unsafe. I saw the Colonel Dragster, who was real fast back then, along with Garlitz and Coletta, and he went off the track at Detroit Dragway, but it, because of the fact they had these berms built up, all he did was run into dirt and nothing ever happened. The car didn't even get destroyed.
It's kind of funny. Tell me about the safety equipment in this thing.
Well, yeah, it's funny because I look at the 61 car and all I had was lap belts. In this car, they made us put helmets on and the big belts, but again, that was it. Today, you got to have a five strap. It's got to be certified every so many years. It's got to be certified. And I have no problem with that at all. I always thought I was safe in a big sedan.
Tell me about the interior. What's in this thing?
Well, it's all stock. If you looked at the car and you didn't know it was a race car, if the lettering wasn't on it, you'd think it was a regular car because it's got carpeting. It's a regular car. These were the way it was supposed to be. That's why you couldn't make a lot of major changes to it. It had to be the way it came off the assembly line, and this car actually came off the assembly line sans motor and transmission and front end. They put it in, at engineering, they put all that stuff in it.
No roll cage or anything?
No. We have a roll cage in the 61 car now, and I never had any of that stuff. And that's a big car. What's funny was when we built this one, my original car, the original Packer car, got in a crash. I was hauling out to Detroit Dragway with a 57, nice 57 Ford. And a semi ran me off the road into the viaduct, totaled both cars, crashed the 61 and crashed the whole side in. Both cars, front and rear, they were both total. In fact, what's even funny about it, and I think about it today, is 57 Fords had an all-metal dashboard. My knee hit the dashboard, put a big dent in the dashboard. And the cops, when they came, they looked at me and they looked at everybody and they said, because there were a couple witnesses that saw it happen. And they said, who was in that car? And I said, I was. He said, are you okay? Because, you know, both cars were total, front and rear, side, everything. You hit a cement viaduct holding up the freeway, you know. And that was it. I didn't feel any bad the next day. I don't know why. Maybe I had a hard knee. I don't know. But denting that dashboard was something else because that was steel.
Thanks for listening to this episode of V8 Radio. If you like what you've heard, you can go to our website at v8radio.com and subscribe, and you'll never miss an episode of V8 Radio. And if you like muscle cars, check out our web show, Muscle Car of the Week. And if you're into restoration and performance cars, go to v8tvshow.com, where you can watch the latest episodes of V8 TV. I'm Kevin Ostey, and we'll catch you next time on V8 Radio.
V8 Radio.